My name is Andrea Luca Zimmermann. I'm an artist and filmmaker, and my work is concerned with marginalization, social justice, and a search for radicalized re-relations between people, place, and ecology. My contribution to Radio Silence hovers between the then and now, towards a world on from tourmaline where tenderness and care is not only possible but inevitable. You, Rajni, along with Astrid and Laura, invited me to a weekend gathering to address the notion of radical equality in an expansive sense, exploring the deep entanglement of contemporary oppressions, including racism, sexism, and speciesism. I met you, Rajni, in 2012, during your Beyond Glorious project, which was one of those generous and welcoming moments of de-isolation and feeling of belonging. And here again, all the participants in this invitation engage with practices of healing, repair, fierce, and with tenderness, and a group I feel a privilege to have been invited amongst. During. Will I have enough to eat? I'd rather not eat at all than just a little. My mother used to make spam with tinned mushrooms and rice. The smell of my dog's food sometimes entices me still. I was accustomed to source nourishment in unexpected places way into my 30s. I knew where to look for it, and I was not alone. Just recently, a friend told me about the schoolgirl he just saw scuffing cold pizza into her mouth at Lidl, and how, wanting to protect her, he blocked the sightline of the security guard, who slowly turned towards them. But he instead said, "Don't worry, I'm watching her, so no one disturbs her." This is care. This is knowing by those who know. Then, I grew up in the 1970s on a council estate populated by alcoholics, immigrants, and anyone the city wanted to place out of sight, in what was called a relief city. My alcoholic, bipolar mother could not cope at all. Having me so early, I made her more lonely. I raised myself. I was a tree hugger. Stefan was often expelled from primary school for wearing dirty clothes. He was my best friend, and we shared a love for trees. My caregiver was so violent that other kids tried to save me by standing outside the door demanding me to be released. A neighborhood dog called Bonnie became my companion. And I had a gang of kids, and we always traveled as far as we could get away. I learned to drive a car at 13. My friends spoke more languages than I. There were sheep running through the estate. Our caretaker was transmasculine and took me to performance bars, which changed my life. Several days before, I'm standing in front of Caravaggio's painting. I was invited to participate in the National Gallery's Unexpected Views to select one of the gallery's paintings and discuss it in relation to my own work. There are many more paintings hanging on the walls of this gallery and its storerooms that may have seemed a more unexpected choice. But Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus was my immediate response, maybe because of John Berger's thoughts on this painting, which I remembered as people got upset about his way of thinking about paintings. To stand in front of a painting, where a brush rendered more than 400 years ago a loaf of bread, to look as if I could grab it today, blows my mind. Caravaggio teaches us about lighting so accurately. I borrowed my way of lighting because of him, and above all, he drove critics mad because, in this version of the painting, in the National Gallery, Jesus was not a bloke. Not long ago, I met John Berger in 2012 while I made a film with Istanbul street dogs and the various human populations and communities that care for them. Reading King, told from the perspective of a dog belonging to an economically and socially marginalized squatter community facing disappearance, gave me the key into my film. The book ends with a dream of survival, so real, so felt, so feverish, a running for sheer life towards refuge, for collective survival, reaching the wide open of a beach, the sea ahead, the sound of bulldozers and police cars drowned by the waves, and upon turning around, the dog sees there's no one else left. It was a fever dream. It's a daring dream to think otherwise, Berger reading sections of King for my film allowed me to find a way to gesture towards a world that might be possible should we allow for tenderness to touch us, regardless of structural and extreme violence. John Berger and Caravaggio. In And Our Faces, My Heart Brief as Photos, John Berger wrote about Caravaggio and it touched me. He said, or wrote, "I discovered that I wanted as little as possible to do in this world with those who wield power. This has turned out to be a lifelong aversion. The complete complicity I feel with Caravaggio began, I think, during that time in Livorno. He was the first painter of life as experienced by the popolaccio, the people of the back streets, the lesons colettes, the lumpen proletariat, the lower orders, those of lower depths, the underworld. There is no word in any traditional European language which does not either denigrate or patronize the urban poor in its naming. That is power." Caravaggio's life an example. Most of my life I lived on different versions of so-called sink estates. The last one, in London, I lived on for 18 years. And because of the stability, I could start a journey of repair. Before he became housebound, one of my neighbors burnt down the remnants of a playground, and this became our bonfire pit. He turned one of the frequently burnt and long-time abandoned cars on the estate into a cat car, and another into a fox car, where he and we put scraps of food. Another neighbor cut off the top of his shoes to make sandals, not because he could not afford new shoes, he said. He didn't want two pairs, so why not be creative? I felt at home there. Whatever I looked like, often not wanting to speak, then wanting to speak, having to listen. I learned to listen. I knew a door would always be open, and mine was. I learned how to look out for each other as a community in difference. The place simply did not conform to the processes of gentrification. The way of being is hard to describe to middle-class people. Their desire for some cleaning up of our attitude. Increasingly, the faces of our community were exchanged with stock photographs and hoardings of young, mostly white, affluent people in suits and short dresses. I likely always will feel drawn to, or most at ease, in less regulated places. My friend, the late writer Paul Hallam, said that ones that can afford to hide it, pretend it doesn't exist, and even worse, denying their own needs, make the world a Puritan hell for the rest of us. Now, John Berger wrote in Why Look at Animals? Because they look at us. My work features animals, often dogs, as they occupy a peculiar and particular space in human history. They show us our power. They see us for who we are, rather than as a number or as an other. They will recognize you. Oh, you're human. They'll either be afraid of us or they'll be gentle because we give them food. To me, urban animals are witnesses in the face of power, the power we grant them and how we appropriate them, including terrifying applications such as when dogs are used as arms of the state against unarmed civilians. My dog would have belonged to the old estate, in tropes of today, a very butch rescue pit bull cross mastiff cross Rottweiler. As a walker sometimes, I come across someone picking up their designer dog and ask, "Did you pick up your dog because of mine?" "Yes, because my dog cost £3,000. We can never know another person fully, and this is where I start from. Context, even deep context, is the starting point for this other journey. I think it depends where one starts a story from how far in, from how far away, who is looking at whom, and therefore, what kind of story does it have to be? Sometimes stories, even poetic or lyrical ones, need context, and sometimes they don't. I find myself treading an unstable ground most of the time, because of how I grew up. I feel perennially in between. I know that there's always a gap between me and the people I work with, and that is what allows the possibility of art, that gap. Film is an emotional medium. It goes both from the body and in the mind. It can do only that which film can do, so I'm interested in cinema in that way. If one allows an open space to work with people, they will bring themselves into the space so much further than one can as a director or as a writer, I think. Imagine it alone. Why I'm drawn to bodies that are able to show us what they carry, words cannot be enough. The ambiguous space of cinema is also its poetic and political possibility, to me at least. I wasn't really conscious of class and its positioning of hierarchies within culture and habituation until I learned that my failure to fit in was also, of course, structural. People are not performing to be somebody else, but who are performing somebody else by also being, inhabiting, having the body of somebody who has been carried by life, whose vulnerability we sense because it is the premise of a new way of being, with each other, for each other. I often don't recognize representations of people of my experience, be it in the realist lens, devoid of beauty, lives reduced to pain, harsh grey, and often with pity to evoke the processes of progress that are just another form of erasure. Beauty is present in our lives. I don't want to deny the messiness and ambiguous boundaries between our experiences and the stories we tell about our lives to ourselves, about ourselves. People in my films refuse to be victimized by structures that are profoundly violent, don't need to be reimagined by a fixing universalist gaze, and instead, those of us working in other ways reclaim, banished to the edges of supporting structures, a multiplicity of filmic space with an obstinacy and waywardness that is boundless. How to make? To resist dominant narratives that erase histories. To reframe denied her stories. To give poetry to the everyday, especially around working class and immigrant experience. To make a counter memory that lays claim to the imagination. To repurpose the myths that exist to oppress. I'm not interested in working in the film industry, the industry that uses the same visual structure and shape to fit in complexity of human experience, the same music to make us feel sad, surprised, anxious, excited. No normal. I don't believe the idea of overcoming one's situation is helpful, as it implies there's an end to something. If this was true, that we can overcome instead of seeing it as a daily practice, we would not have this kind of deadly injustice that we see today. These recent times mean I cannot but think of all those who live in cramped accommodation, without accommodation, in prison actually, or psychically or domestically, without safety for their lives. Had I been locked into a flat as a child, living as I did with a violent parent, I may not have survived. I can never forget that fact. In her essay, The Narrative Reckoning and the Calculus of Living and Dying, poet Dion Brandt challenges the calling for when things return to normal, as if that normal was not in contention. Brandt says, was the violence against women normal? Was the anti-black and anti-indigenous racism normal? Was white supremacy normal? Was the homelessness growing on the streets normal? Were homophobia and transphobia normal? Were pervasive surveillance and policing of black and indigenous and people of color normal? Yes, I suppose all of that was normal. But I and many other people hate that normal. Who would one have to be to sit in that normal restfully, to mourn it, or to desire its continuance? There was no normal before this, and thus there cannot be a return to it. There has to be another way, building resistance. The end.